So, magandang umaga. So, good morning. My name is Tim Gabuna. I'm one of the interns here at Artisan Church, and I'm glad to be with you here this morning. I am the son of two Filipino immigrants, Floyd and Nita, on the left. And after they both immigrated to Winnipeg, Manitoba, individually in the 90s, they met at the Filipino Evangelical Church, where they eventually got married in 1997. And then a year later, I was born. If you can do the math, I'm 26, so maybe that ages you. Anyways, I am a second generation Filipino Canadian. One thing about being Filipino that is confounding to me is the fact that we are almost just predisposed to connect with each other, even when we might not even know each other at all. I grew up with 1,000 aunties and uncles, because in Filipino culture, a family friend or even a kind neighbor down the street is your tito or tita. When you're in a grocery store, you're at church, you're in school, or you're even crossing the street, it isn't like uncommon to strike up a conversation with another Filipino and even eventually become friends or family. Just last summer, when my family came to visit me here in Vancouver, we were in Squamish, and my dad was walking with me down the streets, and then he just saw a Filipino and started having a conversation with him, while I awkwardly just stood by with two long-lost brothers reuniting. They were not long-lost brothers. But Squamish, out of all places, yeah, I didn't know Filipinos could end up there. let me know. So our connective tissue runs deep because we hold community quite tightly. We love the joy that comes in being together. We value the strength that comes in numbers. We want to be close with each other, knowing that we have someone in a time of need. Community is almost not a question to us because we expect hospitality and welcome from each other. That's just who we are. Tragically, this connective Filipino spirit was grieved quite deeply. So today marks 2 weeks since the Lapu-Lapu Day tragedy that happened in the Sunset neighborhood. This festival is part of a worldwide Filipino celebration to honor Datu, or Chief Lapu-Lapu, and his courageous efforts to repel and defeat Spanish colonizer and inquisitor Ferdinand Magellan. Instead, this day has been marked with mourning, anger, and fear. 11 lives were lost, and a number of others are still in critical condition. Their ages ranging from 5 to 65, and some of Filipino descent, and some who aren't. People in my circle witness this tragic event, or know someone who has been directly impacted, and I'm astonished and humbled by the reality that this terrible moment in our city's history has affected almost all of us in some way. And I, along with my Filipino community, are grieving this tragedy. I also know that this grief is not only held by us Filipinos, but it's also held by us as individuals, and wider as a church community, and even wider as a city. I've heard stories of heartbreak, I've held tears with you as well, and so this grief that we hold together is mysteriously both unique in some ways, and yet palpably felt by all of us. So in our sermon series, Imagining Otherwise, we've been looking at different ways to form a new holy imagination. And so by developing holy imagination, this doesn't mean that we're trying to imagine some new kind of faith that's detached, removed from reality, or hyper-spiritualized, but rather we're trying to think, to dream, and imagine together what it could look like to apply resurrection life and joy amidst a world that can seem so bent on destroying it. So what do we do when tragedy has struck like this? How can we come out of the rubble? What is our hope? What can we do next? These are questions that I've been asking myself these past 2 weeks as I've sat in conversation with others, processing my own grief. And I want to imagine a response that goes past thoughts and prayers, something that's more tangible than social media posts of solidarity, and one that brings tangible comfort, hope, and life. So to imagine a better response this morning, we're gonna, yes, look at scripture. And then I also wanna bring in Filipino spirituality as well. My hope is that we kind of just see a through line in order to find a way forward together. So Evelyn read John 11, 29 through 37, but I would like to read it again if we can. So this is on page 749 of your chair Bibles. So we're going to begin in verse 29. Or 28, sorry. So after Martha, she had said this, Martha went back and called her sister Mary aside. The teacher is here, she said, and is asking for you. When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house comforting her noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, see how they love him. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? This is the word of the Lord. So we're jumping into the middle of a story this morning. And for those of us who grew up in the church, you might know this one. So while in the city of Jerusalem, Jesus gets word from his friends Mary and Martha that Lazarus, their brother, is sick. But the catch is that Lazarus is in the nearby city of Bethany while Jesus is over there in Jerusalem. But instead of hurrying to see his friend, Jesus takes his time. Despite the urging of his disciples, Jesus waits. And so then by the time that he arrives over in Bethany, it's already too late. Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. His reasoning? He says to his disciples in verse 11 in the same chapter, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to wake him up. Jesus plans to raise Lazarus from the dead. And if you know the story, you know that Lazarus comes out of the tomb, still in his burial wraps, and he's alive. Jesus raises him to life. The town is astounded by the miracle, and Jesus gains fame and notoriety across all of Judea. It sets him on a path towards the cross and resurrection. And though a beautiful miracle in itself, this is not what I want to focus on this morning. Instead, I want us to just go back a bit in this chapter and witness a specific scene of grief and community that happens in the midst of tragedy and miracle. And so in our gospel passage this morning, we have three groups involved. So we have Jesus, Mary, and the onlookers. When we encounter Mary in the story, we see her secluded in her home with her community, mourning together. Honoring Jewish tradition, Mary is practicing a sacred grief ritual called Shiva. In this practice of mourning, for the first few days, she grieves alone. But after a couple of days, she invites her wider community to grieve with her. And so Shiva embraces a time when individuals can discuss their loss and accept the comfort of others and then slowly re-enter society. And so in Shiva, the grief is never held alone, but together. But meanwhile, in the middle of Mary's Shiva, Jesus arrives at the edge of the village where Martha, Mary's sister, meets him. Martha confesses that Jesus has the power to bring life and that he is the Messiah, and that only he can raise Lazarus from the dead. It's a powerful passage where Jesus reveals that even in the face of death, he can bring forth life. And in response, we see Martha claim in faith-filled confidence that Jesus can do the impossible. He can even raise her brother back to life. And then after this conversation, Jesus asks Martha to call for Mary interrupting her gathering of tears. And with Martha's discussion in mind, I think it's a natural guess that Jesus is interrupting this grief to move towards the miraculous. Because this is what Jesus does, right? The time of death is past. The time for resurrection has come. But instead, we witness something different. Suddenly running out of her house to Jesus, Mary falls down in anguish at Jesus' feet, tears flowing uncontrollably from her face onto his toes. She's buried deep in her pain. She's waiting for any sign or comfort from Jesus. And witnessing this scene are her fellow mourners who follow her to the edge of the village. And looking up to Jesus in desperate sadness, Mary cries out, "Lord, if you had not been here, my brother would not have died." Mary repeats Martha's accusation of Jesus. It's a piercing challenge. For someone who loves Jesus, or for someone who loves Lazarus, as the writer John points out twice at the beginning of this chapter, why did he let him die? How can the one who claims to be the Messiah allow death to happen? It's a raw and honest question that needs answers. But instead of giving Mary a simple answer, John tells us in verse 35 that Jesus was deeply moved in his spirit and troubled. I imagine that the grief of this moment has finally caught up to him. Seeing those who love Lazarus, seeing their honest expressions of confusion and loss, and seeing himself just trying to come to grips with reality, it overwhelms him to the point that he's speechless. It's a human moment for Jesus. His friend, whom he loves, has succumbed to a tragic death. And moved by tears, Jesus responds to Mary's challenge by asking, "Where have you laid him?" And it's not even Mary that responds. The whole crowd says to Jesus, "Come and see, Lord." And so as they walk towards the tomb, Jesus sees the burial place of his beloved friend, and he weeps. The shortness of this verse invites us to imagine this collective grief, this scene. And so I invite you, if you're willing, for a moment, you can either imagine this with your eyes closed or your eyes open. But imagine you're just standing in front of the grave of Lazarus. What do you see? What do you hear? What feelings might come up as you're in this scene? You can open your eyes. So for me, this scene brings me to the events of the Lapu-Lapu vigils on East 41st and Fraser. Two Sundays ago after church, I went with a friend to the memorial. The crowd bubbled up and spilled out onto the street. Filipinos of all ages, those from the homeland, those who grew up here, those who are half Filipino, those who aren't, those who knew someone, those who were just simply holding heartbreak. All of us were laying flowers at the memorial site, lighting candles, and keeping vigil for the spirits of those who passed. Others were offering up breathless prayers. Others were holding each other in grief. We were holding this heartache together. For Filipinos, this sense of togetherness is more than a mystical feeling. In Filipino culture, we call this kapwa, this shared usness. Or as my friend and fellow Filipino, Jan and Melo, would say, kapwa means I am inherently tethered to you. I am cut from the same cloth as you. For us Filipinos, kapwa has always been at the core of our being. The Filipino spirit is kapwa. Kapwa is so poignantly illustrated in this poem from a fellow Vancouverite, Josh, who wrote this in light of the Lapu-Lapu tragedy. They're not my parents, but I call them nanay and tatay. Not my siblings, but still my ate and kuya. Not my uncles and aunts, but always my tito and tita. We live and mourn as one family, and yesterday, we lost part of our own. Filipino psychologist Carl Lorenz Cervantes describes Kapwa as this. Kapwa has no English equivalent. The closest equivalent is neighbor or kindred. To live in Kapwa is to share an inhabited physical and spiritual space where there is unity and the moral obligation to care for our fellow human. It is characterized by the fundamental recognition that I have a shared identity and a shared self. I can never fully be me without you. It is reflecting the image of God more fully because we are together and united in love. Kapwa is who we are called to be. Kapwa is grieving together in the aftermath of Lapu-Lapu for lives cut too short. Kapwa is lamenting together at Lazarus's tomb because a beloved one succumbed to illness. Kapwa is weeping with those who weep, mourning with those who mourn, regardless of your relationship to them, because it's a human thing to do. And yet I want to note that Kapwa is not solely rooted in grief. It's also expressed in life. As my friend Yanan again would say, in Kapwa we lament because we yearn and we strive for better. We strive for something different. We hope and we imagine otherwise. For Filipinos, we have this word that we call bayanihan. I won't make you say it because good luck to all of you. But bayanihan, the sense that because I am tethered to you, Kapwa, I will fight for you. I will help you. Bayanihan. So bayanihan is another Filipino indigenous word rooted in the traditional moving of houses of a family from one village to another, where the members of the village help carry the family's home to their new land without expecting anything in return. The whole village helps not because they are nice or because it's a good thing to do, but because of kapwa, because they know that they belong to each other, they need each other. And as I was reflecting on the response to Lapu-Lapu, I created such like a long list that I was just, yeah, I was struck by how we just responded so naturally and how we responded in this bayanihan spirit. So let me just read out some of these things to you. So in response to this tragedy, nurses and doctors immediately coming in the day of the incident to care for those injured and wounded. Daily vigils were held by neighborhood groups and churches, even across the country in Canada and even in the US. Filipinos held vigil. Several GoFundMes were created to support the victims of the attack, both Filipinos and non-Filipinos, in which the general public responded with an outpouring of donations over exceeding fundraising goals. Heavily discounted or free counseling sessions were offered by Filipinx counselors and allies for victims, witnesses, volunteers, and families. Drop-in spaces across the city were opened as places to be held and cared for, both emotionally and tangibly with victim supports. Specifically, the Resilience Center in Killarney Public School functions as a place to drop in, have a meal, and check in on each other. Meal trains were organized by Filipino restaurant owners around the city and are still doing it now. Tens of fundraisers and community nights started arising from Mai Tai matches to donut sales to karaoke nights. And finally, I've had so many check-ins from friends and family with each other, and just folks just making sure that everyone was accounted for, making sure everyone is safe. And that's not even the whole list. If you want to know what the power of Kapwa is, this is it. In defiance of grief and tragedy, the Filipino community chooses not to allow death to have the final word, but for life to live on. We refuse to live out, to isolate ourselves in our own grief, but instead to come together and work for justice and hope, to fight in bayanihan spirit. For those who call ourselves people of faith, Kapwa is the Holy Spirit that tells us that life is worth fighting for. It's at the core of who we are. So when we live in Kapwa spirit, and when we work in bayanihan spirit, We realize that in a world of hyper-individualism and polarization, full of oppression for those on the margins and of callousness to pain and suffering, we could make our neighborhoods and cities better places of shalom, peace, and justice instead. How could we receive one another if we chose to embody kapwa instead of antagonism? How could our communities be if we responded with such concern for the good of our neighbors? Could we extend friendship and hospitality to each other without needing to face a tragedy to do so? The sad reality, as German artist and scholar of Filipino culture, Catherine de Guia, says, sadly, in today's Philippine society, this kapwa orientation is buried, like finding gold dust in the riverbanks. It may have to be winnowed again from layers and layers of heavy colonial sand. So how do we overcome a monumental task? If you bear with me, I was reading John this week with Ecclesiastes. This text was written from a period of Israel's ruinous history, a political and religious collapse where the kingdom split in two. Injustice, murder, and greed reigned, and God's presence abandoned their people. I think Ecclesiastes is actually a word for us today as those navigating crisis. And I was struck by these verses in Ecclesiastes 4. So let me read them to you. And if you want to follow along, it's on page 463, beginning in verse 9. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no life to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. So for the writer of Ecclesiastes, there's no quick and tidy solution. In the face of their national and personal crisis where seemingly all is lost, the call is to come even closer together. There's no promise that everyone will come out the other side unscathed, but the writer simply pleads that in the crux of catastrophe, we are much better together than we are alone. I appreciate the words of Black feminist and activist bell hooks when she writes, "Rarely, if ever, are any of us healed in isolation. Healing is an act of communion." When I think of the many acts of Bayanihan that happen in light of Lapu-Lapu Day, from the first responders to the drop-in centers and the fundraisers and the meal runners, I know that these acts of solidarity are not only acts of kindness and compassion. These acts of Bayanihan are also struggles against the forces of sin and evil and empire that try to tell us that these tragedies are simply just normal in the ways of a fallen world. So when we come together, when we pick each other up, when we carry each other's burdens, we do so in the spirit of kapwa togetherness, yes, but also in a defiant struggle against death, against all things that are enemies of life. Filipinos have a word for this too. It's pakikibaka, or shared struggle towards life, towards shalom. I love what my friend Jobin said last week when sharing about our aching visionaries night, when he said that pursuing justice and shalom doesn't need to be grand or extraordinary. Even reaching out to a friend and offering them a meal and friendship is a defiant act in a world that tells us we shouldn't be helping one another and that we should be pulling each other up by our own bootstraps. Our works of kapwa are like a mustard seed growing even in hard, tough soil, slowly struggling to take root, but eventually growing into a fully grown tree, flourishing of life. Filipino theologian and writer J.D. Gonzalez writes, "From my perspective as a Filipino in the diaspora, kapwa is our inheritance, a gift to the Filipino people, and in turn, a gift that the Filipinos share with the world and with all of humanity, our kapwa tao. It is a gift that keeps on giving, for Kapwa is our lens through which we are able to glimpse the infinite beauty of the divine image, the image of Christ in the other. So when we come together in community, we see the whispers of risen life. We can experience the goodness of being beloved and being known. And in light of tragedy and disaster, we're not called to run and hide, but to hold tighter, to be held, to be kapwa. When we come together in community, whether in grief or celebration, Christ's love becomes visible, tactile, fragrant, auditory, and delectable, as theologian Norman Wiersbe would say. Love felt and love shared becomes more than simple well wishes, but love becomes tangibly known and felt. And so to end, I'd like to share just a tangible expression of Kapwa in this video of community organizer Sammy Rumbawa. So this was taken at the vigil 2 Sundays ago in Kensington Park, a day after Lapu Lapu. And then I would like to share just a poem from local teacher and coach, Saul, who reflected on this moment.
There is a saying called Isang Baksak, and it means when one falls, we all fall. But again, when one rises, we all rise. And I just felt compelled to really do this with the community to end. And it is part of solidarity and organizing. And it does come from the civil rights movement. And so what's gonna happen is that we're all just gonna clap, and we're clapping all in different beats because we're all on different paths and we don't know what to do and we're all confused. But as we clap together, we get synchronized and we get louder and louder. And then when I yell, Isang Baksak, we all try to land on one clap. So I've never done it with a big group like this before, but I just felt that we can try to do this. Game? All right, so it's the heartbeat of the community, okay?
This poem is by teacher and coach Saul, who's in the city, and it's titled The Garden on Fraser and 41st. Bitter taste on my tongue when I call my own people resilient. I prefer to call us by something else. Kapwa, a shared self. On the news, they named Saturday the darkest day in Vancouver's history. On Sunday, the candles we ignited turned Kensington Park into the night sky. We clapped at the vigil, crescendoing into an Isang Baksak, one down. As in when one falls, we all fall. Conversely, we rise together. And on Sunday, we sounded like thunder. On Saturday, our home was turned into a crime scene. On Sunday, we laid flowers to rest and turned Fraser and 41st into a garden. Amen.